blind. A few days earlier, Trump's team of data scientists, squirreled away in an office down in San Antonio, had delivered a report titled Predictions 5 Days Out, which contained stunning news that contradicted the widespread assumption that Clinton would win easily. It was suddenly clear that Comey's FBI investigation was roiling the electorate. The last few days have proven to be pivotal in the minds of voters with the recent revelations in reopening the investigation of Secretary Clinton, the report read. Early polling numbers show declining support for Clinton, shifting in favor of Mr. Trump. It added, "This may have a fundamental impact on the results." The report's authors further detected plummeting support for the Democratic candidate among early voting African Americans, down 18% from 2012, and a reduction of turnout in urban areas relative to rural areas, which together were shifting the electoral demographics sharply toward Trump in the key swing states of Ohio, Virginia, and North Carolina. The deeper you dove into the data, the more it appeared that the hidden Trump support, postulated by Trump and ridiculed by most analysts, was in fact quite real and heading to the polls. Yet these voters weren't being accounted for in public polling, or even those conducted by Trump's pollsters and the RNC. So the scientists, in their stilted jargon, modeled what the electorate might look like if turnout includes a simulated increase in low propensity voters that has been apparent throughout this election cycle, what they dubbed a Trump effect. This exercise illuminated a clear electoral path for Trump. 10 different paths, in fact, most of which entailed winning Florida, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, that now looked entirely plausible. It gave Bannon hope that no miracle would be necessary. Like its namesake, Trump Tower is given to hyperbole. Its southwestern facade folds accordion style, so that the building magically produces dozens more corner offices and apartments than a typical glass slab. Although the top floor is labeled as the 68th, this is an illusion. A flight of stairs outside Bannon's 14th floor office leads down one level, directly to the 5th floor. Trump skipped over numbers when labeling the floors, which is how a building that the city records as having only 58 floors was able to sell the more exclusive and expensive, but fictitious, floors 59 through 68. It was on the unfinished 5th floor, once used as production offices for Trump's reality TV show The Apprentice, that the campaign had set up its Election Day operations a week earlier. By late in the afternoon, lawyers, political operatives, and assorted Republican officials and hangers-on were anxiously buzzing about the rows of folding tables as they awaited the results. The most exclusive among them, a rotating cast of Bannon, Conway, Spicer, and Priebus, along with Trump's spokeswoman, Hope Hicks, his running mate, Mike Pence, and assorted Trump offspring and their spouses, squeezed into a 10-by-15-foot storage room built from makeshift drywall partitions. Bossie dubbed it the Crack Den. Its walls were plastered with bumper stickers and posters bearing chest-thumping declarations of purpose. Donald Trump. He will get things done. Along with, incongruously, a painting of a teddy bear and a blue butterfly smiling at a potted sunflower. Bill Stepien, a hard-bitten former top aide to New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who was Trump's national field director, set up a projection TV that beamed an electoral map from his laptop onto a wall. The laptop contained an RNC dashboard that automatically populated the Associated Press's county-level election results as they rolled in. There had been a sudden scare. Just after 5 p.m., the first exit polls splashed across the Drudge Report, showing that voters were deeply dissatisfied and longing for change. But they also showed that Trump was tied with or trailing Clinton in nearly every critical swing state. Bannon pulled Kushner out of the Crack Den so no one would register their panic. "What do you think?" Kushner asked. "Well, the numbers tell two different stories," Bannon replied. If you believe one set, we're killing it. It's a change election, and everything lines up exactly like we thought. But man, if you believe the other one, we're getting crushed. It was a moment of truth and a dilemma. The Cambridge Analytica model had picked up a late shift in the electorate toward Trump, but it was only a model. These exit polls were based on thousands of interviews with actual voters, and they were telling a much different story. Not knowing what else to do, Kushner and Bannon called Matt Drudge to ask what he thought. "Fuck the corporate media," Drudge told them. "They've been wrong on everything. They'll be wrong on this." Solace came slowly at first, and then in a great gusher. On the wall of the crack den, Stepine was clicking through swing states, rattling off numbers like an auctioneer. The campaign had prepared a list of bellwether counties that it thought would provide the earliest indication of its fate. These included not only the traditional swing counties that cable news pundits always puttered on about, places such as Loudoun County, Virginia, and Jefferson County, Colorado, but also areas brimming with older, white, working-class, Trump Republicans, places like Okaloosa County in Florida's Panhandle and Mahoning County in eastern Ohio. The campaign's thinking was that if counties like these broke decisively for Trump, then so too would the vast swaths of the upper Midwest that they were depending upon to forge a path to victory. On TV, the cable networks had for several days focused obsessively on the surge of early votes in Latino-heavy counties, such as Florida's Miami-Dade and Nevada's Clark, all but promising a Clinton victory and a humiliating comeuppance for Trump. Stepien's projector showed a different surge. The numbers in Okaloosa County were through the roof, certain to surpass the 2012 Republican totals by a mile. "This is beyond where we need to be," Stepien enthused. The dead heat that exit polls showed in Ohio also proved to be a mirage. It soon became clear that Clinton didn't have a prayer of winning the Buckeye State. And while Wolf Blitzer made great drama on CNN about the large Democratic counties in Florida, Broward, Miami-Dade, that were still outstanding, Trump's brain trust had already determined that he'd won the state, based on the extraordinary turnout in the Panhandle. Furthermore, they knew that if Florida fell into their column, the Cambridge model, grandly dubbed the Battleground Optimizer Path to Victory, put Trump's odds of winning at around 80%. But it was the states Trump wasn't supposed to win that told the story in the end. Bannon was fixated on Michigan, constantly urging Stepien to click back over and zoom in on bellwethers like Macomb County. And with 30%, 40%, then 50% of precincts reporting, Trump's lead was holding steady, or growing. As the night wore on, he even led in Wisconsin, a scenario none of Trump's data scientists had ever imagined. Later on, several of those crammed into the room would recall a moment when Stepien's manic patter flagged for just a second and the room fell quiet. Then somebody, no one could remember who, muttered, "Holy shit, this is happening." Drudge was right. The corporate media blew it. And they knew it. The calls and texts came pouring in. At 9:05 p.m., a frantic reporter emailed Bannon, "Can't believe what I'm seeing. You guys are going to win, aren't you?" His curt reply, "Yes." In newsrooms everywhere, pre-written "Clinton wins presidency" stories were being frantically updated or simply trashed. Sensing suddenly that history was unfolding in their midst, a couple of Trump's advisors whipped out their phones and began snapping pictures. As word of what was occurring spread through the building, more and more people crammed into the room. Chris Christie showed up and squeezed in next to Ivanka Trump. Then Ivanka got a phone call from her father. He and Melania were coming down from the penthouse. Donald and Melania Trump were not, it was instantly understood, going to wedge themselves into the filth and stink of the crack den. No, Trump was headed for the 14th floor war room, with its 30-foot-long wall of televisions. All at once, the room emptied out, as operatives and family members began scrambling for the elevators or the stairs. Only Stepien paused on his way out the door to scoop up his laptop and projector. By 10 p.m., Trump had stationed himself at the center of the war room, where he stood facing the five big-screen televisions bolted to the wall and taking in the full spectrum of the cable news meltdown he was presently precipitating. Mike and Karen Pence sidled over to join him, and soon dozens of staffers and family members surrounded them to watch as the networks called a steady procession of states for Trump. Stepien set up his projector around the corner, in an alcove near the desk of Trump's senior policy advisor and speechwriter, Stephen Miller. A junior aide was dispatched to race back and forth from the projector to the war room with the latest electoral tallies, like a marathon runner carrying news to the emperor in ancient Greece. Spicer hurriedly summoned a video crew from the fifth floor to begin documenting all that was happening up above. Before long, the room was packed. Trump remained riveted to the television screens, and while his aides obsessed over each incoming block of voters added to the map, which part of the state did they come from, which areas were still outstanding, Trump hit upon a simple metric that cut through the minutiae and went straight to his odds of winning. "How did Obama do there in 2012? He would ask, each time a county's numbers were updated. By and large, the answer was that the key counties in states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Ohio that had produced narrow victories for Obama in 2012 were now showing narrow, and sometimes not so narrow, Trump leads. On TV, the cable anchors were working hard to keep up the level of drama, but the scenarios they were spinning for how Clinton could win were becoming narrower and more far-fetched with each passing minute. No one was quite sure of the moment when Trump realized that he was going to be the next president. Although he was surrounded by friends, aides, and family members, there seemed to be a hidden force field around him that discouraged a direct approach. So instead of approaching Trump, most well-wishers began congratulating a beaming Mike Pence, whom they high-fived and saluted as Mr. Vice President. After a while, Trump, perhaps needing to absorb the gravity of what was happening, went and sat down. A moment later, Christie burst through the force field and sat next to him. "Hey, Donald," he said, "the president talked to me earlier." Christie knew Obama from their work together in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. "If you win, he's going to call my phone and I'll pass it over to you." Trump flashed a look of annoyance, clearly resenting the intrusion. He was also, his aides knew well, a fanatical germaphobe who would not want Christie's cell phone pressed to his face, not even for the deep satisfaction of hearing Barack Obama congratulate him on having defeated Clinton. Still, onlookers were startled when Trump snapped, "Hey, Chris, you know my fucking number. Just give it to the president. I don't want your fucking phone." Christie's move was, one witness later recalled, the ultimate mistake. It was one from which he wouldn't recover. Finally, Trump stood up and began to circulate among the crowd. Word had gone around earlier in the day that Trump probably wouldn't attend his victory party a few blocks away at the Hilton Hotel unless he was certain of the outcome. Now, Bannon informed the team, his decision had been made. "He's going to the Hilton," Bannon said, "but first, he's going to go upstairs." Spicer realized that this meant they would all be going over to the Hilton. Somehow, that made Trump's victory feel official. As Trump headed toward the elevator to return to the penthouse and collect himself, Spicer ventured forth to pay his respects to the man who would soon become the next president of the United States. "Congratulations," Spicer said. Trump just stared at him and uttered two words. "Not yet." It was Bannon who finally delivered the news, although by then it could hardly have been a surprise. "Hey, look, we're going to win this thing," he said. Trump nodded, sensing where his chief strategist was going, and replied, "Let's go get this done." Trump was alluding to his victory speech. He didn't have one. Nor had he prepared a concession speech. Aware that his boss was deeply superstitious, so much so that journalists had witnessed Trump tossing salt over his shoulder before meals for good luck, Bannon had intuited that he wouldn't respond well to the hoary political tradition of writing out two speeches ahead of time, and so had simply never raised the subject with him. Trump wouldn't want to jinx himself, he was sure. Truth be told, Bannon loved this part of Trump, his easy willingness to say, "fuck that," to any number of venerable traditions without so much as a moment's thought. Pure honey badger. He sometimes wondered whether Trump would even bother to take the stage in the event of a loss, and half suspected that he wouldn't. But that scenario no longer applied. When they arrived in the penthouse, Trump, Bannon, and Miller gathered in the kitchen, along with Ivanka and her husband Jared, to decide how Trump should address himself to a shell-shocked nation, a shell-shocked world. Trump made clear that he wanted a speech that would bring the country together, something presidential that would salve the wounds of the bitter campaign and at least crack open a door to millions of stunned Clinton supporters struggling to get their bearings. When he got up on stage, he'd surround himself with his family, too, to give Americans a fuller, softer glimpse of the man who would be leading them. Miller roughed out some lines about how it was time for America to bind the wounds of division and time for us to come together as one united people. As midnight struck and Clinton's carriage turned into a pumpkin, the penthouse started filling up with VIPs. Trump's sons, Don Jr. and Eric and their wives, Melania and 10-year-old Barron, Conway and communications advisor Jason Miller, Rudy and Judith Giuliani, the Pences. Then, loudly and boisterously, inevitably, Chris Christie emerged from the elevator, eager as ever to join the party. He made a beeline for Trump. It's one of the main reasons he got fired, one attendee later insisted. Trump hates being smothered, and Christie just got under his skin. Trump and his writing team moved to the dining room. Eventually, 30 or 40 people were milling around, excitedly buzzing about the upset they were witness to, and waiting for the president-elect to head to his victory party. There was no longer any doubt that he would prevail, or do so by a comfortable electoral margin. But Trump decided that he wasn't going to leave for the Hilton until the Associated Press called Pennsylvania, thereby slamming the door on even the one-in-a-million shot Clinton had left. The AP's call came at 1:39 a.m., and a roar went up in the penthouse. It was time to go. The Secret Service ushered Trump and his family toward the awaiting motorcade, with Bannon and Miller in tow. Down below, Spicer and several of his RNC colleagues threw on their jackets and decided to walk the four blocks to the Hilton. Although by now they were certain of victory, they wondered what Trump would say. There had still been no word from the Clinton campaign. A week earlier, Clinton's campaign manager, Robbie Mook, had reached out to Conway to choreograph the election night formalities. Mook had informed her that if Clinton lost, she would call and concede 15 minutes after the AP called the race. But should Clinton win, he added, if we don't hear from you after 15 minutes, she's going to go out on stage and give her victory speech. Bannon thought the message was arrogant, a veiled threat that Trump had better fall in line, and told Conway to ignore it. Trump was just preparing to take the stage at the Hilton when the AP made the call. At 2:34 a.m., the news flashed across the wire. Breaking. Donald Trump is elected President of the United States. Quickly, Bannon and Priebus huddled with him to figure out what he should say. And then, just as Mook had promised, the call came from Clinton. Her prompt, graceful concession was, even Bannon had to admit, very classy. And with that last, outstanding bit of business put to rest, Trump and his family took to the stage and made it official. From the far left end of the stage, half eclipsed by Conway, Bannon stood gazing out over the raucous crowd, still absorbing the news of the AP's call. Total shit show, he thought, approvingly. It was true, and not least because the audience was filled with Bannons. More than 20 of his relatives, including his 95-year-old father, Martin, were on hand for the celebration. One relative even became a minor icon of sorts when the next day's Bloomberg Businessweek chose for its cover an image of a stereotypical Trump bro in a red Make America Great Again baseball cap, grinning like a jackal and pointing at the camera. It was Bannon's nephew, Sean, a total fucking hammerhead, as he put it, affectionately. After the Hilton shut down and the revelers spilled out onto Sixth Avenue, Spicer, still unable to process what had just happened, found himself roaming the streets of Manhattan alone, not ready for the historic evening to end. He wandered north for a while until he hit Central Park. Then he turned east. Finally, realizing the chaos that dawn would bring, he decided to head back to his hotel and turn south. His path took him down Fifth Avenue, right past Trump Tower. As he was about to cross 56th Street, he noticed flashing lights and looked up. Trump's motorcade was just pulling up to the tower's residential entrance. As it rolled to a stop, a door flew open, and a grizzled, grinning, disheveled figure, with two pens still clipped to his shirt placket, hopped out and enveloped him in a bear hug. Spicer, grinning wildly, reached out an arm and snapped a selfie. And it was at that moment, at exactly 3:27 a.m., standing with Bannon in the pitch black outside Trump Tower, that the magnitude of what they had accomplished finally sunk in. They had just carried off the greatest political upset in U.S. history and sent Donald J. Trump to the White House. In the days after the election, the world wondered, how could this happen? Many people still wonder. No shortage of scapegoats and malefactors were offered up by way of explanation. James Comey, the Russians, the media, fake news, sexism. The list went on and on. Yet none was entirely satisfying, or big enough to encompass the scale of the shock, or capable of unwinding the sense of dislocation so many people felt when they awoke to the realization that something so seemingly unlikely, so utterly extreme as Trump's election, could happen in plain view of everyone, without anyone really seeing it coming. It was like the opening scene of a Hollywood thriller, the sudden jolt that makes you sit upright in your seat, and after which some remarkable, winding backstory is gradually revealed. But the revelation never arrived. Even now, there's a sense that some vital piece of the puzzle is missing. That piece is Steve Bannon. From Machiavelli to Karl Rove, politics has a rich history of the genius figure whose plots and intrigues on behalf of a ruler make him the hidden hand behind the throne, the wily strategist secretly guiding the nation's affairs. So familiar has this story become that it's a trope of American political journalism. If you're a presidential candidate without a brilliant strategist, the media will often take it upon themselves to anoint one you never knew you had. The strategists, aware of this narrative compulsion, openly jockey to win the position. Although he's been cast in the role, Bannon is no such figure, or in any event, he doesn't fit the typical mold any more than Trump fit the mold of typical presidential candidate. What Bannon is instead is a brilliant ideologue from the outer fringe of American politics and an opportunistic businessman whose unlikely path happened to intersect with Trump's at precisely the right moment in history. For years, Bannon had been searching for a vessel for his populist, nationalist ideas, trying out and eventually discarding Tea Party politicians such as Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann. At the same time, he was building an elaborate machine designed to destroy the great enemy whose march to the White House posed the biggest threat to those ideas and to everyone whose beliefs hewed to the right of center, Hillary Clinton. In 1998, when Clinton first posited a vast right-wing conspiracy bent on ruining her and her husband, she was widely ridiculed. But she wasn't wrong. By the time she launched her 2016 campaign, Bannon was sitting at the nexus of a far-flung group of conspirators whose scope and reach Clinton and her campaign didn't fathom until far too late. At first, Bannon didn't understand that he'd found the figure he'd been looking for. Trump wasn't a serious candidate and would never deign to let some rogue figure govern his behavior. That much was clear from the outset. But Bannon soon discovered that Trump's great personal force could knock down barriers that impeded other politicians. And Trump, for his part, seemed to recognize that Bannon alone could focus and channel his uncanny political intuition with striking success. Bannon didn't make Trump president the way Rove did George W. Bush, but Trump wouldn't be president if it weren't for Bannon. Together, their power and reach gave them strength and influence far beyond what either could have achieved on his own. Any study of Trump's rise to the presidency is therefore unavoidably a study of Bannon, too. It's a story Trump won't like, because he isn't always the central character, and because, contrary to his blustery assertions, his victory wasn't a landslide, didn't owe solely to the force of his personality or his business savvy, and happened only due to a remarkable confluence of circumstances. This confluence occurred in large part because Bannon had built a trap that snapped shut on Clinton, and the success of this, too, was an incredible long shot. In fact, the whole saga of Bannon is every bit as strange and unlikely as that of Trump. He's like an organism that could have grown and blossomed only under a precise and exacting set of conditions. A black orchid. This book is the backstory of how those conditions came to be. It's the part of the movie you haven't seen. To understand Trump's extraordinary rise, you have to go all the way back and begin with Steve Bannon, or else it doesn't make sense. 2. Where's my Steve? The Trump-Bannon partnership, like so much else in Trump's life, has a bizarre and winding lineage that traces back to a lawsuit. In the mid-1990s, Steve Wynn, the Las Vegas casino mogul, was looking to move in on Atlantic City, New Jersey, a possibility that threatened the livelihoods of the Trump Plaza Hotel and Casino, the Trump Taj Mahal, and other gambling establishments along Atlantic City's boardwalk. Unable to make headway, Wynn's Mirage Resorts, Inc. filed an antitrust suit against Trump's company and Hilton Hotels, setting the stage for an epic showdown. At the time, Trump and Wynn were both in their 50s, both graduates of the University of Pennsylvania, both fiercely competitive giants of the casino industry, possessed of healthy egos, and operating at the peak of their powers. And perhaps because they shared so much in common, they were bitter enemies. "They hate each other's guts," a casino analyst told the Philadelphia Inquirer. "It's like poison." Right away, things had gotten very strange. A private investigator working for Trump's defense team had gone off to dig up dirt on Wynn and Mirage, only to switch allegiances partway through his assignment and secretly defect to his target. The resourceful sleuth, whose tradecraft included using a modified jockstrap with a hidden tape recorder and microphones concealed in a belt, turned over to Wynn the secrets he had purloined for Trump, later claiming that he was moved to do so by a crisis of conscience, and not, as Trump's lawyer suggested, a $10,000-a-month consulting deal with Mirage. Wynn and Mirage sued again, this time claiming that Trump's company had engaged in a conspiracy to steal its trade secrets, including a list of high-rolling Korean gamblers about whom, Wynn's suit alleged, it spread dark rumors of money laundering and mob ties in hopes that Wynn Resorts would be denied a New Jersey casino license. The lawsuit revealed, among many other colorful details, that the investigator had given his counterintelligence mission the code name Operation Soul Train, S-E-O-U-L. An attorney for Trump likened the investigator, not unreasonably, to Judas Iscariot. Wynn shot back that the case exemplified the most outrageous misconduct, the most flagrant violations of law and decent behavior in the history of the resort hotel industry. It was all about to explode into open court, until on February 23, 2000, the case was abruptly settled. A week later, the reason became clear. MGM made an offer to buy Mirage Resorts that eventually netted Wynn, its largest shareholder, around $300 million. Wynn's designs to build a casino in Atlantic City never came to fruition. In the aftermath, with both men having effectively won their battle, Trump and Wynn became friends. And that is how, several years later, at a fundraiser for Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C., Steve Wynn called his friend Donald Trump over and introduced him to a man who would soon set the course for his unlikely political rise, David Bossie. By the time he met Trump in the late 2000s, Bossie, then still in his early 40s, was already a hardened veteran of Washington's political wars. Smitten with Ronald Reagan as a teenager growing up in Boston, he became youth director of Bob Dole's 1988 presidential campaign, and then a foot soldier in Newt Gingrich's Republican Revolution when the GOP took back the House of Representatives in the 1994 election. Not long afterward, the beefy, buzz-cut, hyper-intense Bossie, who still resembles a Dick Tracy villain, landed a job as chief investigator for the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee. The job put Bossie at the beating heart of the Republican anti-Clinton movement that was then still picking up steam, and in the employ of perhaps its fiercest prosecutor, Representative Dan Burton of Indiana, the committee's new chairman. Even before Burton took the gavel in 1997, his unhinged zeal to take down Bill Clinton was the stuff of legend. A few years earlier, convinced that the 1993 suicide of Clinton's deputy White House counselor, Vincent Foster, was in fact a cold-blooded murder, Burton had recreated the event by shooting a watermelon with a pistol in his backyard in an effort to prove his theory. He didn't convince too many people, but he did earn the enduring nickname Watermelon Dan. When he became oversight chairman, Burton quickly laid waste to the committee's tradition of august bipartisan restraint and seized on its considerable legal powers, in particular the power to issue subpoenas, to torment the Clintons, often by dispatching his chief investigator to hound anyone he suspected of abetting them. Bossie required no special encouragement. He routinely evinced a zealousness that matched or even eclipsed that of his boss. The New York Times once described him in a news story as a relentless ferret. He cut a strange figure. A volunteer firefighter, he lived in a firehouse in Burtonsville, Maryland, where he slept in a bunk bed and responded to emergency calls when he wasn't racing off in pursuit of real and imagined Clinton perfidies. But some of these Clinton scandals were legitimate, and Bossie, who was often first to document them, was a favorite source of political reporters, to whom he reliably leaked the latest incriminating details about the First Family, even if his methods rubbed some of his own colleagues the wrong way. Not long after Bossie's arrival, the Oversight Committee's counsel abruptly quit, blast-faxing to reporters a letter of resignation that attacked the unrelenting self-promoting actions of the committee's investigative coordinator. Relentlessness and self-promotion were no sins in Gingrich's Washington, but Bossie's fanatical desire to fell the Clintons at any cost eventually did him in. Burton's committee developed a troubling reckless streak that led to unconscionable errors. In their determination to prove that Clinton was illegally taking money from Chinese donors, Burton's staff fired off hundreds of subpoenas, sometimes targeting the wrong person. In 1997, for instance, his investigators mistakenly subpoenaed the telephone and financial records of an elderly Georgetown University professor named Chi Wong, who happened to share a name with a major Democratic donor. And yet, when Bossie was apprised of the error, he still wouldn't relent. "Whether he deserves a subpoena or not, we haven't decided," he said of the innocent professor. "If you make a mistake, and we're not sure we made one, you want to look into it." But it was Bossie's recklessness in a different Clinton investigation, this one involving the jailed former White House Associate Attorney General Webster Hubbell, once a partner at Hillary Clinton's Little Rock, Arkansas law firm, that finally brought about his downfall. In 1998, Burton released some transcripts of prison recordings of Hubble's private telephone conversations. Hubble had been convicted of fraudulently billing his law firm. Burton went on Nightline and Meet the Press to announce that the conversations implicated Clinton herself in the fraud. The media, by now conditioned to tout Burton's charges, went into overdrive on what looked to be a major news scandal. Burton didn't know it, but he was about to walk into a trap. His Democratic counterpart on the Oversight Committee, Henry Waxman of California, was a legendary investigator himself, with a clever and sharp-eyed staff alert to Bossie's recklessness. At the time, Waxman's oversight investigation of the tobacco industry was being made into the Oscar-nominated Al Pacino-Russell Crowe film, The Insider. While conducting its own forensic examination of the Hubble transcripts, Waxman's team discovered that the excerpts Burton had released to the press had been doctored in such a way as to appear to incriminate Clinton, when the full transcript plainly did not. They had a good idea of who the culprit was. Rather than simply issue a press release, Waxman devised something far more attention-grabbing and dramatic. The following Sunday, Burton was booked for an encore appearance on Meet the Press. The show's host, Tim Russert, was quietly made aware of the discrepancy between the two sets of Hubble transcripts. Political hit jobs like the one on Burton are always disguised in order not to divert focus away from the target. The public story of Russert's triumph, detailed afterward in New York Magazine, was that Russert himself discovered the divergent transcripts. He did not. He was a fine journalist, but here he had some help. On Sunday, when the cameras began rolling, Burton became an unwitting captive as Russert, the dean of Washington journalism and a maestro of the prosecutorial interview, confronted the chairman on air with evidence of the doctored transcripts. The uproar was immediate and intense. Gingrich, humiliated, condemned Burton's committee as the circus. Republicans fumed at the embarrassment Burton had brought on them and demanded he atone for it. The Washington Post splashed the story across its front page. Burton apologizes to GOP. The whole edifice of probity and professionalism that Republicans had painstakingly constructed to give themselves license to go after the Clintons seemed to come crashing down at once. The Burton investigation is going to be remembered as a case study in how not to do a congressional investigation, and as a prime example of investigation as farce, declared Norman Ornstein, a respected congressional scholar at the conservative American Enterprise Institute. The fallout landed heaviest on Bossie, who was very publicly fired from his job. Once a feared and respected figure who operated in the innermost sanctum of Republican power, he was now cast far, far outside it, to the fringes of the conservative world. The subsequent collapse of the Republican power structure, including Gingrich's resignation as House Speaker, brought about by the backlash to Bill Clinton's impeachment, only ratified Bossie's status as persona non grata among respectable mainstream Republicans. Bossie, however, did not disappear or even leave Washington, D.C. Nor did he abandon his obsession with taking down the Clintons. Instead, he became president of the conservative group Citizens United, a position that gave him reign to become what he was probably best suited to being all along, an uninhibited, full-time, generously compensated anti-Clinton warrior, whose plots and intrigues could now be funded by wealthy conservative ideologues. The job made Bossie a big deal in a small but intense universe of rabid Clinton haters. He arrived at a pivotal moment. By and large, the public rejected what this group's members regarded as their great triumph, Clinton's impeachment, and punished Republicans such as Gingrich, whom they deemed responsible for it. For those who had fought so long and hard to damage Clinton, this unexpected turn of events only deepened their animosity and drove them further from the mainstream of the GOP. Their influence waned. A new Republican president, George W. Bush, got elected by championing a different, more compassionate conservatism, while holding the right-wing fire breathers at bay. Bossy's ilk continued nursing their obsession, blasting out fundraising appeals, making overheated political films, propagating dark conspiracy theories that revolved around the Clintons, and gathering at the sorts of conferences where intense adherence to far-right-wing causes set up tables to lure new recruits, and vendors hawk merchandise pitched to the politics of the crowd, such as Hillary Clinton nutcrackers, and bumper stickers that read, "Life's a bitch, don't vote for one." Yet for all its fevered efforts, this group rarely made a ripple outside its own insular bubble. Its members were mostly cranks who wound up speaking mainly to one another. Republican politicians were happy to receive their votes. Many, in fact, depended upon them, even as they privately held the cranks in low esteem. As one campaign manager for a Republican presidential candidate described them, "They're the stuff you scrape off your shoes. Bad people." Yet in one instance, the Clinton haters did manage to break through in a big way, and Bossy was the man responsible. In 2007, in anticipation of Hillary Clinton's run for the White House, Citizens United produced a scalding documentary film that purported to detail a thicket of nefarious Clinton scandals, although it consisted mainly of interviews with off-kilter conservative commentators such as Dick Morris and Ann Coulter, maligning the former First Lady. Bossy's plan was to release Hillary the movie as a cable television video on demand in January 2008, just as the Democratic presidential primary was getting underway. In truth, it was more of a fundraising ploy than a serious effort to sway Democratic voters, who would be unlikely to seek out a film attacking their leading presidential candidate, much less be turned against her by the opinions of the right-wing talk radio hosts who were its central characters. But Bossy didn't get very far. The Federal Election Commission prohibited Citizens United from advertising the film on the grounds that Hillary, the movie, constituted a campaign ad. The new McCain-Feingold campaign finance law restricted so-called issue advertisements that mention federal candidates from airing within 30 days of a primary and 60 days of a general election. Bossy sued, claiming his film was protected commercial speech and therefore exempt from campaign laws. A three-judge panel of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia denied his request for an injunction, stating that his film was effectively a 90-minute campaign ad, susceptible of no other interpretation than to inform the electorate that Senator Clinton is unfit for office, that the United States would be a dangerous place in a President Hillary Clinton world, and that viewers should vote against her. Yet in 2010, the Supreme Court disagreed and sided with Bossy in Citizens United v. Federal Election Commission, a landmark decision that said political spending is protected speech under the First Amendment, and corporations and other organizations can therefore spend unlimited amounts of money to support or denounce candidates in an election. Republicans were ecstatic. The Supreme Court case briefly turned Bossy into a conservative cause célèbre, not because Republicans thought his film would have any effect on Clinton, who had already been dispatched by Obama, but because it was the vehicle that eliminated campaign spending restrictions, opening the floodgates for more corporate money to pour into electoral politics. It bestowed upon Bossy a temporary glow that made him seem like a big deal and a consequential player in Republican circles at the very moment when Donald Trump was getting serious about running for president and casting about for advice. Trump had few connections to the political world, where no one took him seriously, even though, and in part because, he was kicking up a shitstorm by claiming that Obama had faked his birth certificate and wasn't really born in the United States. And yet, Trump was hardly dissuaded. His habit always was to quiz anyone and everyone about what they thought, whether or not that person could claim any expertise on the topic at hand. In Trump's mind, then, Steve Wynn's opinions about politics and how to shape it were every bit as valid and worth listening to as those of a seasoned political consultant, and maybe more so because Wynn had traveled a path so similar to Trump's own, not just in business, but also in politics. Nguyen, too, had once been a Democrat and even claimed to have voted for Obama in 2008. But he turned sharply against the president and the Democratic Party after the election, and would later get into a tabloid-friendly fight over the subject with the actor George Clooney, who once stormed out of Nguyen's dinner party after the casino magnate called Obama an asshole. For Trump, who was trying to figure out how to navigate national politics, Nguyen's imprimatur of Bossie and Bossie's own post-Citizens United celebrity both counted for a lot. Trump brought Bossie into the fold, later describing him this way: solid, smart, loves politics, knows how to win. By March 2011, employing a style that would soon become familiar, Trump had orchestrated the birther crisis over Obama's citizenship, roiling the political world and making himself a central figure in the national conversation. Now he faced a dilemma. Nguyen had invited him to be a guest at his three-day celebrity-studded Las Vegas wedding on April 30th, where Clint Eastwood was going to be the best man. But the Washington Post, eager to capitalize on Trump's sudden political notoriety, had invited him to be a guest at the White House Correspondents' Association dinner that was being held the same night. Trump had accepted both invitations. In the end, he decided to attend a Friday night party in Las Vegas honoring Nguyen and his fiancée, Andrea Hissom. Trump mingled poolside with Sylvester Stallone and Hugh Jackman. Then, early the next morning, he jetted off to Washington, D.C., where the comedian Seth Meyers was going to emcee the correspondence dinner. Trump had no idea that Meyers and Obama were anticipating his arrival and preparing to make him a national laughingstock. And none of them knew that this elaborate humiliation would be the catalyst that put Trump on a path to the White House. It was a setup from the beginning. Trump had been invited to the correspondence dinner by Lolly Weymouth, the daughter of the Washington Post's legendary publisher Katharine Graham, and someone who routinely courted stars and celebrities as guests to the annual event held at the Washington Hilton. Trump's invitation had caused grumbling in the Post newsroom. Was it really appropriate, reporters wondered, for the paper to embrace the purveyor of a racist conspiracy theory directed at the nation's first black president, who would, not incidentally, be the dinner's featured speaker? But ever since 1987, when, in the wake of the Iran-Contra scandal, the journalist Michael Kelly brought one of its central figures, Fawn Hall, the document-shredding secretary to Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, to the event, there had been an unspoken competition among prestige media outlets to land the most notorious and newsworthy guests. In the social context of elite Washington, the Post's nabbing Trump as a guest was a coup. And Trump was, by all accounts, delighted to be among the actors, starlets, and television personalities who flock to the A-list dinner each year. Knowing that the dinner speakers typically single out members of the audience for roasting, and that Trump was a ripe target, a couple of Post reporters asked him if he was prepared for some ribbing. Trump waved them off. "I'm fine with this stuff," he replied. Trump was seated in the very center of the Hilton ballroom, his confection of blonde hair aglow in the bright lights, his star wattage eclipsing the graying eminences of journalism and politics who craned their necks to get a look at him. No one confronted him about his outrageous slander or questioned why he was so intent on humiliating Obama, because doing so would have run counter to the spirit of the evening. Instead, Trump schmoozed and flattered his fellow guests, and they in turn schmoozed and flattered him. Nobody knew it yet, but the president and his staff would not be so solicitous. They had, in fact, been eagerly awaiting Trump's arrival in Washington from the moment the news became public, recognizing the occasion as the perfect opportunity to exact a humiliating revenge. Obama's writing staff even brought in a ringer, the comedian and director Judd Apatow, to help its most comedically gifted speechwriter, John Lovett, compose a devastating takedown of Trump. The White House Office of Digital Strategy had agreed to produce a video compliment. Toward the end of the evening, when the lights dimmed for Obama's remarks, giant screens throughout the ballroom broadcast a blaring music video of Rick Derringer's cheesy rock anthem, Real American, that the digital strategy team had crammed full of over-the-top patriotic imagery. Rippling American flags, screaming eagles, Uncle Sam, and then Obama's long-form birth certificate came dancing across the screen. The White House had just released it 3 days earlier, after months of Trump's haranguing suggestion that Obama couldn't produce it because he hadn't really been born in Hawaii. As the lights came up, Obama stood at the lectern, grinning broadly and looking right at Trump. "My fellow Americans, mahalo," he said. "As some of you heard, the state of Hawaii released my official long-form birth certificate. Hopefully this puts all doubts to rest. But just in case there are any lingering questions, tonight I'm prepared to go a step further. Tonight, I am releasing my official birth video." Now the screens showed a clip of Disney's The Lion King, bearing a timestamp that read, August 4th, 1961, Obama's birthday. The crowd hooted and laughed. "Donald Trump is here tonight," the president announced. "Now, I know he's taken some flack lately, but no one is happier, no one is prouder to put this birth certificate matter to rest than the Donald. And that's because he can finally get back to focusing on the issues that matter, like, did we fake the moon landing? What really happened in Roswell? And where are Biggie and Tupac?" The crowd laughed louder. Trump sat frozen in a rictus grin. Obama kept after him. "All kidding aside, obviously we all know about your credentials and breadth of experience. Here, Obama paused to let the laughter die down. "No, seriously, just recently, in an episode of Celebrity Apprentice at the steakhouse, the men's cooking team did not impress the judges from Omaha Steaks. There was a lot of blame to go around. But you, Mr. Trump, recognized that the real problem was a lack of leadership, and so ultimately you didn't blame Lil Jon or Meatloaf. You fired Gary Busey." Obama started cracking up, but kept on going. "These are the kinds of decisions that would keep me up at night." The crowd roared. "Well handled, sir. Well handled." Myers was up next. After methodically working through the field of 2012 Republican presidential hopefuls, he arrived at his real target. "And then, of course, there's Donald Trump," Myers said, with a devilish grin. "Donald Trump has been saying that he will run for president as a Republican, which is surprising because I just assumed that he was running as a joke." Trump reddened. "Donald Trump often appears on Fox," Myers continued, "which is ironic, because a fox often appears on Donald Trump's head. If you're at the Washington Post table with Trump and can't finish your entree, don't worry. The fox will eat it." More laughter. "Gary Busey said recently that Donald Trump would make a great president. Of course, he said the same thing about an old, rusty birdcage he found." Gone from Trump's visage was any pretense that he was enjoying this. He did not seem to possess the ability to laugh at himself, nor even the politician's ability to smile broadly and pretend to. Trump was plainly humiliated, and it showed. When Myers was finished with him, Trump, looking shaken, beat a hasty retreat. He had been incredibly gracious and engaged on the way in, Marcus Brauchley, the Post's executive editor, would later say. But after his drubbing, Trump had departed the dinner with maximum efficiency. To all outward appearances, Trump had just been brutally dispatched, his dignity snatched away from him, his foray into politics swiftly cut short, the preening, grasping interloper who had barged into a world where he didn't belong sent crawling back to his rightful station, a tawdry world of bimbos, pink marble, reality TV, and Page Six. This is what all of Washington understood to have happened, for years afterward. Trump had made another of his absurd, periodic displays of pretending to contemplate a run for president, ventured too far in his quest for publicity, and suffered a terminal humiliation. Now the universe had snapped back into balance and ejected him. Only, that wasn't what happened at all. Trump had indeed toyed many times before with running. The first time, in 1987, he was about to publish his book, The Art of the Deal, when a Republican activist in New Hampshire launched a presidential draft campaign. One day that fall, Trump, then 41, disembarked from a black helicopter onto an airfield in Hampton, New Hampshire, and gave a speech to 500 people at the local Rotary Club, many of them waving "Trump in 88" and "Trump for President" signs. Striking notes that could have been sounded in his 2016 campaign, Trump claimed that the United States faced disaster because it was being kicked around by the likes of Japan, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, countries that were laughing at us. He added, "It makes me sick." Trump never entered the race, but people responded. He drew headlines. His book became a bestseller. In 1999, he went a step further, quitting the Republican Party and actively campaigning for the Reform Party nomination. Ross Perot had founded the Reform Party to fight the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, and push a balanced budget, mounting a pair of White House bids in 1992 and 1996. While the Reform Party has faded from memory, in 1999, it represented a serious political vehicle because it assured its nominee access to all 51 ballots and money from the Federal Election Commission. Those said to consider pursuing its nomination included everyone from Oprah Winfrey and Sybil Shepherd to Warren Beatty and Pat Buchanan. Trump, sizing up Winfrey as the biggest star, declared her his dream running mate. While he reveled in the attention that came with his presidential flirtation, Trump also seemed to absorb some of the ideas and tactics that had animated Perot's success. He rushed into print another book, The America We Deserve, that railed against NAFTA and aped Perot's famous warning about a giant sucking sound of American